Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Okay, so I'm kind of beside myself excited this afternoon to speak with Robert P. Jones. I didn't ask you ahead of time, but I noticed in the book, you gave a little dialogue where you introduced yourself as Robbie, and I'm kicking myself because I'm like, I'm gonna ask him, can I call him Robbie? Because I think you signed your email back to me. So anyway, we'll say Robert P. Jones, very official this morning.
There you go. And now you can go to Robbie. Yeah.
And we'll go to Robbie. Great. Yeah. So Robbie's here. I'm super excited. Robbie, the new book is The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future that I just finished yesterday. I just want to say for the record, A, I thought it was really great. B, I thought it was really hard.
Yeah.
This is a really, really tough book to read. So just for folks who haven't maybe heard you on a podcast yet or haven't grabbed a copy of it yet, the reason that it's hard is because you share, I mean, my mind went to, I categorized it in a certain way and just kind of said you had kind of six paired case studies with violence and displacement and genocide, really, of Indigenous people, and then also lynchings of African Americans that have all taken place in the U.S. since we've been the U.S., which is kind of how you intro the book, which is debatable where we kind of start that timeline. But each one of those stories, there's connections, even though they may not be completely obvious on the surface. And there are stories of violence. And so they're really, really tough to read and tough to reimagine and tough to come to terms with. So I just kind of want to, I mean, that feels really heavy, but I just want to kind of say that up front, that's where I was when I left the last page yesterday.
Yeah, well, it certainly is challenging history. And I think it's one that, you know, we really have to be able to face because it is our history. Now, it's not the one that most of us learned, you know, from school or the textbooks we got handed. And I think that's, you know, I've got a PhD in religion, right? So I'm overeducated, took a lot of religious history courses, you know, history of the church, et cetera. And I just never got these stories, you know, anywhere. And they're not just stories of, I think what's important for me and why, you know, a person like me, so I'm white, Christian, grew up in the South, grew up evangelical, that these stories aren't just about others, right? They're not about African Americans. They're not about Indigenous people. Of course, they are about those, but they're also about us. And I think we often think that somehow that history, that African American history isn't our history, or that Indigenous history isn't our history. But, you know, the thing that I'm coming so clear about is that we can't really understand who we are if we don't understand our interactions with African peoples and with Indigenous peoples. And it's just something, I think, tellingly that we don't get from our, you know, whether it's public school or private school. I mean, I went to public school, then to a private college, private Baptist college. But neither in my public school in Mississippi nor in my private Baptist, you know, college did I get really any of this history.
Yeah. So thanks for sharing that. That made me think of two things. The first is I was mindlessly scrolling through Instagram last night, and Jamar Tisby in his stories was referencing comments. I didn't see the comments, but he was had shared something with his class that his class, you know, kind of became
they had a strong response to because they hadn't learned it in their history, right? And Jamar's a historian.
Yep.
And so his response was, look, I'm a historian. I do this for a living. And there's lots more stuff that we don't know than we do know. And we're all still learning. And so I just think I love that from Jamar. And I just kind of want to name that to say for those of us who, because there's a lot of things in this book I didn't know. And some of it I did. But to just like kind of say, even in this conversation, like, there's not shame in not knowing. We're all still learning. And so if we haven't heard this, you know, let's open our eyes to it, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, just to, you know, I try to be pretty honest about this in the book that I, you know, even again, like I make my living kind of understand, you know, that's kind of my professional role is like understanding the role of religion and in America. And even 5 years ago, you know, before I started doing the research on this book, you know, if you had quizzed me about many of the kind of indigenous interactions, I would have known very little about it. So, I mean, this book has actually been a project of kind of self re-education in many ways and trying to kind of teach myself the history that I didn't get taught.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that came to my mind as I was reading this is that not only have we missed Indigenous history and African American history, which is a huge part of who we are as a nation. But I had the thought several times, this book could be, in some ways, there could be different versions of this for different people groups, right? Who have immigrated at different times or who have been present. You know, I'm mixed Hispanic. My mom's side is Mexican American. And one of the things that was asked of me several years ago was, you know, it was my great grandmother who was the first to be in the States. And the question I got was, did she cross the border or did the border cross her?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as I continue to think about things that I have learned from my own Latin history is that this, there could be a book written with a shared history here too. There could be with Asian American people groups, you know, there could be, you know, I was even reminded my husband's family is Italian. They weren't always white in quotes,
right.
You know, and faced discrimination and these kinds of things. And so, you know, that so many people groups could have their own version of this book in some ways and how their treatment, mistreatment could be tied to the roots of white supremacy.
Yeah, I think that's right. One thing I hope, you know, even though I mostly focus in this book on the kind of like European, African, European, indigenous interactions, like those aren't separate from the story you just told, right? If you look at, so why is Spanish spoken in the America, all up and down the Americas, right? Well, there's a colonial story, you know, behind that. It didn't just pop up, right? It came over from Spain and part of that kind of colonial, you know, so like in the, so I, you know, I write three chapters on Mississippi, and you know, I begin that that history with Hernando de Soto from Spain, right, coming over, you know, in 1451, and say, look, that's really the, you know, if we really want to understand how we got to Emmett Till and the murder of a young black teenage boy for allegedly whistling at a white woman, and why that was an offense punishable by torture and death, and then the killers acquitted. If you want to understand that society, you've got to go back, right, to understanding this kind of first European contact. You know, really not too far away from where Emmett Till was killed is where Hernando de Soto, you know, like discovers, quote unquote, the great Mississippi River and lays claim to that land for Spain.
Yeah. Yeah. So I realize I'm getting ahead of myself. So let's lay out a little bit what you've done. I think that'll be helpful for listeners, folks who haven't read it yet. So I mentioned earlier kind of six case studies, kind of paired case studies. And the way that you line that out after you've got some wonderful intro chapters and then a couple of really great conclusion chapters, which spoiler alert, that's where I wanted to start was with some of the things that you bring up in the conclusions. But in the meat of the book, you take one of the things that's fascinating to me is you take kind of three different regions. And I want to point that out because this is a conversation that I've had with people who really have in their minds, especially if they didn't grow up in the South. You grew up in Mississippi. I grew up in Oklahoma, by the way. So you get three chapters in this book. I get three chapters in this book. Our homelands do. But even for people who have not grown up in that area of the United States, there is sometimes still this mentality of, oh, racism is a Southern problem, you know? And so I just want to point out, you have three chapters on Mississippi, three chapters on Minnesota, and three chapters on Oklahoma. And so we've got, I mean, we don't have the East and West Coast covered, though they are mentioned and to different degrees in the book, and they're definitely not, you know, excluded from our history in this way. But this, but the point is to say that this isn't like something confined to region. It's also not something confined to time. And it's not something that has gone away. It's not entirely in our history. And so what you do is connect some of the really brutal history of the European and indigenous history to the also brutal treatment of African Americans. And so you have some really displacement, massacre, genocide connected with lynchings and a race massacre in Oklahoma. And so one of the things that you point out in the conclusion is that it's easy for us to compartmentalize these histories and say, okay, we have a Native American history here. We have an African American history here. But one of the things that you're really trying to put forth in this book is that these are not siloed, and these, we can't compartmentalize them, that they are connected. So can you talk about those connections and kind of how you sought to do that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I start actually the book with a scene that's actually not from the South or from Oklahoma. It's from Minnesota. And it you know, but it connects. So just briefly, the opening scene of the book is I'm telling the story of a man named Robert Hickman who set out to free himself. You know, he heard that the Emancipation Proclamation had been freed. Had been issued, but because he was in, he lived in Missouri, which it didn't apply to. I think we often forget that the Emancipation Proclamation only applied to states that were in rebellion against the Union. Missouri at that time did not qualify, so it didn't free anybody in Missouri. But he was literate and a local pastor, and he took it upon himself. He was like, "Well, whether or not it officially applies to us or not, we're going to take this opportunity and go." And he and his family and friends, it was kind of a mass escape. I mean, there were 76 of them that went, just pushed themselves out into the river on a raft as a way of escaping Boone County, Missouri, hoping to get picked up by a steamboat heading north. And they actually did get picked up, and they got taken all the way to St. Paul, Minnesota. And, you know, just a couple little scenes here, like in St. Paul, they tried to disembark at the city and were threatened by Irish dock workers who thought they'd be competition for jobs and would have been beaten. The police actually sided with the dock workers and prevented them from disembarking. They actually pushed up river further and got taken off or disembarked at Fort Snelling, which is a federal fort there. But what they encountered there is, was the clashing of these two narratives, right? As they were disembarking to freedom, they encountered really the same day, the federal troops were loading up the remnants of the Dakota people onto the same steamboat to deport them from the state of Minnesota. And so, you know, the way I put it in the book is, you know, what we have right here in one scene is, you know, the beginnings of emancipation for one group and the end of sovereignty and exile that had already followed genocide of another group. And you know, that I think is the, you could tell that story in most states in the country, right? I mean, I could have had 50 chapters. Instead, I kind of chose to have three. But the story of first forced indigenous removal and genocide connected to enslavement of Africans. It, in many ways, is the American story that we don't want to tell ourselves, right? And what's behind that, I think, is even more importantly, who's driving that? What's driving it? It is white European Christian people that are justifying it and driving it.
Yeah. one of the ways that that's being justified and driven is that I would say it won't be familiar to many if we use the term doctrine of discovery, though we can talk about that.
Yep.
But I would say the ideal that America is a promised land is something that is very familiar to people. Maybe they haven't verbalized that.
We might even hear that today sometime.
Certainly, certainly. Yeah. And I want to go back to this, to even this like central region of the U.S., because one of the things that I learned from your book that connected some dots for me and is not, now, granted, I get it. When I'm thinking about fourth grade history, how are we teaching that? There are some things that just aren't very nuanced, right, when we're in elementary school. Yeah. And I didn't end up becoming a history major by any stretch of the imagination. But at the same time, I think that we obviously can do a better job. So I'm talking about the Louisiana Purchase.
Mm.
What I learned about the Louisiana Purchase from your book was fascinating for me, because I think as in the way that it was taught to me was familiar indeed to you, which is this was a great deal.
Greatest real estate deal in history. That's
greatest real estate deal in history. But talk about what the fine print, what the actual meat of that contract actually meant.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, this was basically, you know, the European powers in a room making decisions over land that none of them actually controlled, right? That were inhabited mostly by indigenous people who were completely unaware of this backroom deal making going on between the European powers. And so, you know, it was a time where France was ready to relinquish like its control of these lands, but that control was only on paper. I mean, there were a few forts scattered here and there, but by no means was there like control of this land or even fully settlement or occupation of any of these lands in the Louisiana Purchase. So what was really purchased was not real estate in the way that we think about it, but in the technical terms of the day, it was the right of preemption that was purchased. And so what Jefferson purchased from France was the right of preemption, which means the right of European powers, and by extension, the U.S. as a European colonial power, newly independent, but yet kind of still drawing on this European legal concept, that they had purchased from France the right to be the preemptive power and to be the ones who had the legal claim from a European perspective to all those lands. Now, again, all the indigenous people that were inhabiting those lands up and down the Mississippi River from Minnesota to New Orleans, like no clue that over here, these white people were, you know, kind of wheeling and dealing away, supposedly, the rights, you know, to their lands. But that's the way, I mean, it's stunning. Frankly, I didn't know this either until I really started reading up on it. I was like, oh, wait a minute. Like, so whatever, you know, the great purchase price was, it didn't give them free title to it. It just gave them the rights to claim those lands over and against indigenous people.
Right. Which is, anyway, it just blows my mind. I want to stay there for just a second. Because many Americans, we are coming back. There are these people have worked to do land acknowledgments, right? And things like this. There is work being done. At the same time, I'll just share a tiny bit since I'm from Oklahoma. I lived there until I was, you know, almost 30. So went to school there, public school, same, you know, I grew up using the language of five civilized tribes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It was only several years ago that I called my dad. I'm like, I'm sorry, what do we say? Because it was just the language. I didn't even think about it as a kid, of course. And I was a grown woman in my 30s. I'm like, Dad, I'm sorry. What do we say now? Like, what do we actually say anyway? He said five tribes. So, but I grew up with that language. And I also worked for the state government when I was in my 20s. And part of what my job required was that I would go to county court for various things. And I was aware that Indigenous peoples were in the judicial system, there was a difference, right? So this was something for me because of the sovereignty of each nation that is represented in Oklahoma. Now, what always blew my mind, and especially with some of the more recent rulings, is wait a minute. Like, if we know that the U.S. didn't honor basically any treaty that they had with any of the Indigenous peoples, much after the ink was dry. But with some of these things, I kept thinking, well, wait a minute. If they're sovereign in this way, and we're required to go back in this way, what about the land?
Yeah.
What about the land? And Robbie, you talk about that a bit, but can you, I mean, it's pretty convoluted. Can you just say more about how convoluted this is? Because I feel like this is things that we're still living out after the Louisiana quote purchase. These things are still being played out in ways that are still in unjust and unfair.
Well, it's pretty clear. Ned Blackhawk has a great new book, out where he kind of talks about the Louisiana Purchase here. I'm thinking about that now. And he makes the point that, like, one of the motivations for Jefferson also wanting that, you know, control over that big plot of land and having France relinquish it was that he wanted space to push westward, right? To push European colonization westward across the Appalachian Mountains into the interior. But he couldn't do that because it was all under control of France. And he also wanted space. He also saw that those lands for the Louisiana Purchase could be used to displace Indigenous people who were in the original 13 colonies, and particularly in the Southeast along the Gulf Coast. And it's exactly what the U.S. government did in very short order. By 1830, we have the Indian Removal Act, you know, which is forcibly removing people, Creek, Chickasaw, Cherokee, and we end up with that term, five civilized tribes, because they were the principal tribes that were moved from the Southeast by force, came to be called the Trail of Tears, or surely called the Trails of Tears, plural, because there were many waves of this. You know, tens of thousands of people die on this kind of forced march, sometimes taken in the dead of winter with very few supplies. And they're essentially herded mostly to Oklahoma. I mean, Oklahoma was quote unquote Indian territory before it was a state. And the one other reason why Oklahoma looks so strange in terms of its borders is because other newly formed states just kept taking bites out of Indian territory to become new states. And eventually what's left is that funky looking, state sitting on the top of Texas, this little panhandle. So it's kind of a real convoluted story there. But even then, I mean, that's the thing, is that even when you have all of these Native American tribes have ceded all of this land in the Southeast, they're herded into this one little place that's called Indian Territory that then gets called Oklahoma. Even that's not enough, right, for European settler colonialism. So even that is not sufficient deprivation. So then there's a whole other process of, even after all of those tribes who are resettled there get promised, we will never encroach on your borders. Like, these are yours forever in return for ceding all this other stuff in the Southeast. It's very shortly again. I mean, I think it's worth pausing over what you said about, you know, it really is true that, you know, and these treaties, when you read them, they have words like, as long as the grass grows green and the rivers run, this agreement will be, these lands will be yours. Like, they were very lofty and permanent promises, right, that got made as a way of kind of leveraging them off of lands that they were on. But it's worth kind of remembering, like, that's us, right? Like, you know, that's our government that made those promises and then very quickly broke them. And they broke them because really there's no other way. It's just greed. And the word that I think it may be a vocabulary word that wasn't really in my arsenal is the word rapacious. And so I've used it a couple times in the book. I actually got it from I came across it first in this context from Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote Democracy in America. And so in the English version, it gets translated rapacious, but it just means like insatiable greed, aggressive, insatiable greed. And I think that's really, you know, the story is pretty simple. But then all of these other principles get evoked. That word civilized is not also accidental, all right? So there's a way of it. What it means is that we're going to recognize these five tribes, but that means these other hundreds of tribes we're not even going to like recognize because we consider them uncivilized. You know, like our Declaration of Independence, for example, has the words merciless savages in it, right? That refers to indigenous people in the Declaration of Independence, right? So that was the default way. So in a way, civilized tribes was supposed to be a kind of recognition that these five tribes, you know, the U.S. could deal with, right? And we helped organize them. But even then, right, the reservations were pretty quickly broken up. There was this whole thing called allotment, which basically was a total unethical scheme to deprive Native Americans, even of the lands they had been promised on the reservations. And it just ends up being this kind of winnowing down, right, of sovereignty and land until there's not much left. And just one quick, I know I'm rambling here, but one quick example, I just can't resist this. Killers of the Flower Moon, the movie is coming out.
Hey, ramble, because that is exactly where I was going to ask you to go next. Yeah.
And it gives this story, right? Because the Osage, right, who had been actually in Oklahoma, moved out of Oklahoma, moved back into Oklahoma, like ping-ponged around by force. They finally get pushed on to what the white settlers in Oklahoma think is a worthless kind of scrubby land you can't farm. They think they're worthless. And lo and behold, they're sitting on massive oil reserves, right? Even after getting pushed onto these worthless lands. And what happens, of course, is all of a sudden, white people are now interested in even those lands, right? And you know, the story tells them, the movie tells this awful story of the lengths to which white European, again, mostly Christian people are willing to go, that even reaches into intentionally marrying into indigenous families with the plan to kill off spouses and children to inherit Native American head rights to those oil reserves. I mean, that actually like happened, not just by one rogue person. This was kind of a pattern of behavior, you know, there. And it's just beyond words, really, to comprehend that kind of premeditated, you know, again, all the other disenfranchisement is not enough. But when oil is there, and you can tell the same story of Cherokee and gold being discovered in the northern Georgia mountains or California gold rush, same kinds of stories that lands that indigenous people were promised when they were discovered, anything valuable was on them. They found all kinds of excuses and in many cases didn't even find an excuse, just use sheer violence and force to push them out.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really glad you went there. Cause like I said, that was the place I was going to ask you to go next. And it was on that insatiable greed.
Yeah.
So full disclosure, my plan coming into this was to really focus on the stories that happened in Minnesota, in part because they were the ones I was least familiar with.
Yeah.
I read a book by, I can never remember the author's name, journalist, Washington Post, wrote a great book on Emmett Till that I read several years ago. And so I was pretty familiar with his story, you know, in Oklahoma. I became familiar, more familiar with Greenwood and Black Wall Street and things like that, but I was less familiar with Minnesota. But I'm shifting and saying, we got to talk about Oklahoma because this greed piece is so evident in these two stories. So Killers of the Flower Moon, the book came out maybe, I don't even know, 15 years ago, probably.
Yeah, it's been out for quite a while.
It's been out for a while. I didn't read it. And so reading about it in your book was like reading it for the first time for me. And I was, of course, shocked and appalled, not surprised because of the greed that not just our government, but that European Americans have like shown this, you know, this pattern. as you know, as you said, there was one of the stories I think that you mentioned in there of even like, again, violent, but like a slow poisonings, right? I mean, just like really, really sick, really, really sick situations because of this greed, you know? And like you said, on a land that they thought was worthless when it ended up not being worthless. I think there's a greed, but to me, when I read the stories of the Osage people and of Greenwood District in Tulsa, what also comes to mind is there's no way for me to get inside the heads of the people who are committing these atrocious crimes, but it's like, there's also an envy. Like, we can't handle seeing a people group that doesn't look like us actually succeeding or becoming wealthy, or, you know, it's a really tough thing to kind of say out loud, but it's like, it wasn't enough to be greedy for it to, you know, but it's like, but we also are saying with these actions, you can't have that, you know, Osage people, you cannot have the wealth that comes with that oil. And for the African-American community, that was arguably one of the wealthiest communities at the time, wealthiest African-American communities at the time in the country. It wasn't enough to say, we want that, but it was also, you can't have that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, I think we, this is where we haven't mentioned the words white supremacy yet. And I think this is maybe a good place to talk about it. You know, that I think many times when, you know, I use the word white supremacy, particularly if I'm talking in white circles, you know, people envision the KKK, or the image that comes to their mind is like a grainy black and white image of the KKK burning a cross in the 1920s, something like that. And I think that that's honestly like a kind of self-protective way to think about white supremacy, because it means it's way far away from us in time. It's way far away from anything we can imagine being a part of, you know, for most of us anyway. But, you know, it really is this sense that, you know, as you said, you know, some of the language that we have is not far off of that. Like, so this idea of the U.S. as a promised land for European Christians. Right. That if we have that view of the country, then if anybody is above white European Christians, then the world is literally upside down. You know, there was a phrase that Ken Burns used in his Civil War series. I think he named actually the entire thing. And it was a Confederate soldier writing back after the loss of the war. And the way he describes the world is, he says, the bottom rail is on top. And that's it's a metaphor about a fence, about those split rail fences, right? And so there's a top rail and a bottom rail. And in that worldview, of course, white Christian people are on the top of that, and they're supposed to be on top. And so this sense that the world, you know, is inverted, and that there's a hierarchy, you know, that's the thing. There is a hierarchy, and it's not random. In this worldview, it's God ordained, right? And so it means that if indigenous people are getting ahead, if African American people are getting ahead, whether it's power or money, either way, that's why there was such efforts to keep both indigenous people and African Americans from voting, right? Because that would lead to power, influence, and structural change, and that was not the way the world was supposed to be. From that point of view. And that idea is not that far away from us, you know? Right. I mean, we want to think it is, but it's really not that far away from us. And as you said, it's not a Southern thing. You know, there were plenty of stories from Minnesota, right? That you can't get much further north and stay in the U.S. than Minnesota. And there's plenty of racial challenges and problems in Minnesota. I mean, that account of the lynching in Duluth, which is also far north, even in Minnesota, it's up on the lake. You know, on the tip of Lake Superior. And, you know, if you, that account of the lynching of three African-American circus workers in 1920, I mean, it sounds just like it's out of Alabama, right? 10,000 people turned up, in this small, you know, it's a tenth of the population of the town, at the time. And this, you know, Minnesota, nice, good Catholic Lutheran town. Right.
Yeah. 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 Thank you for bringing that up and bringing it back to white supremacy. And when you say it's not far from where we are now, I live in Texas. So there's lots of voting issues here now. And also you mentioned it in the closing chapters of the book, a couple of places that I'm thinking of right now. One is, I read a lot. I'm going to be embarrassed if this is not in your book, but I think it is, talking about the two churches.
I might just claim it if it's good.
Two churches who were interacting, and one of the churches says, let's watch Hidden Figures. Is this?
Yeah, that's
okay.
In the book.
Okay, let's watch Hidden Figures.
It's in
right?
Tulsa, actually.
Yeah, yep. Right. And the pastor of the Black Church said is like going, I don't think this is going to be a great place for us to start, right? Because of what you said, one church is looking at this as a historical thing. Oh, we've triumphed, we've come out, you know, but we can still talk about the pain of the past. And the other community is recognizing, no, this is the pain of now. And the other thing I thought of, and I'll let you just kind of choose your own adventure, is when we're talking about voting rights, white supremacy, the great replacement theory that is driving a lot of politicians and public even now, right? What would happen if, and then name, you know, your group, if this people were given the opportunity, equal opportunities for voting, holding office, sharing power. Even existing in this space.
Yeah, it's. I'll start there actually, because I think that's really important. When you think about the kind of tropes that are kind of rolling around our politics, like that, like the Great Replacement Theory, which you know shows up on Fox News, Newsmax, other kind of far right things, and it's such a kind of a, you know, it's just such a hateful rhetoric, right? It's a kind of demonizing other people. We've actually asked about this in public opinion surveys at PRI, and it's remarkable what a foothold it's gotten. So we, you know, the question, the way we phrased it in a survey question is, do you agree or disagree with this statement? And the statement is, immigrants are invading our country and replacing our cultural and ethnic background. Right. Turns out that 38% of the country agrees with that statement. But there's just huge partisan divide, and divide by you know, kind of media outlets. But like, it's 2/3 of Republicans who agree with that statement. It's 15% of Democrats. So it's like one of their biggest partisan divides is on a question like that about, and it does come down to again the kind of things we're talking about. Who is this country for, right? Who are real Americans, right? These are the big dividing points, and they are so connected to this long, long, long history, right? Where, and again, back to this kind of key point, we've also asked in today public opinion surveys, so, you know, about how is this with us today, we've asked a question really about this doctrine of discovery, this idea that that the U.S. is a, and we asked you, again, do you agree or disagree that the U.S. is ordained by God to be a promised land for European Christians? So we've got whiteness, Christianity, God, all in the question. And it's, again, 3 in 10 Americans who say yes. Now, that means 2/3 of the country disagrees with that assessment of who the country is. But there's still 3 in 10 Americans that are affirming that old idea that drove the entire colonial project, right? It drove the transatlantic slave trade project, that idea.
Can we stay on that one for a second? Because that graph is in the book.
Yep.
And when I looked through it, one of the things that drew my attention, and it was kind of interesting to see. So the partisan breakdown I anticipated, and the religious breakdown I largely anticipated, but I did circle the Jewish bar on that, because for me that felt like a marker, because of we could go into a whole lot of religious things on that, but to use the language of a new promised land and to note that religiously Jewish respondents are like not on board with that statement.
Right.
Almost whatsoever. Right. Like they're the lowest bar next to religiously unaffiliated who were the same. And so I don't need to necessarily elaborate on that, but it did kind of make me like chuckle and sigh at the same time because of, again, of, you know, replacement stuff and borrowed language and anyway, all sorts of religious stuff that you could get into. Yeah. White evangelical Protestants have the highest bar on that. And it is broken down because Hispanic Protestants are lower, Black Protestants are lower in the bar, but white evangelical Protestants, higher than mainline, have the highest bar of agreement for that statement at 56%.
Yeah, no, that's right. And so it you know, it lives on, right? This 500-year-old idea, you know, it's still with us today, and it's still roiling our politics. It's not like it's off in a corner on the fringes, you know, somewhere. But I mean, our key debates and even the way the parties are identifying, you know, we've I think, to my mind, unfortunately, only have two political parties, right? So we've got this binary lens that everybody's forced into, particularly every 4 years, and we're about to have another one of those, you know, 4 years coming up. But it has become part of the package, you know, on the Republican side of politics today. You can just measure it, you know, in the and it is this kind of old claim about, you know, who the country's for, who we are as Americans, who's a real American. And I'll just, you know, to say it's I think it's obvious, but to say it plainly, I mean, it's a fundamentally anti-democratic view, right? We can't both be a pluralistic democracy where everybody stands on equal footing before the law and be a divinely ordained promised land for European Christians. Like, those two things are mutually incompatible.
Well, I want you to say more about that, if you would, please. And I'm going to kind of like shout out my dad and hopefully not embarrass him at the same time. But my dad, studied in graduate school, studied political science. And I have said of my dad before, I don't think that my dad is necessarily prophetic, but what I think is he's very perceptive. And so things that, for example, conversations that I would have with my dad and things that he would say, let's say 5 years ago, I'm like, you are nuts. Like, there is no way, right? And then you fast forward about 3 years and you start to hear some really perceptive political commentators saying the same things that my dad are saying, you know, had been saying. And people are saying to them, maybe you're far off, or maybe you're exaggerating a bit, right? Fast forward a couple of more years, and this, you know, the time frame is ambiguous, arbitrary depending upon the topic. But this saying, this is an anti-democratic ideal. Like, this is a conversation I was having with my dad several years ago, right? That I'm like, I don't know, you know. And fast forward to now, you're going, yes, absolutely. Like, this is an anti-democratic ideal because you can't be both things, like you said. And so I've just repeated what you've just said, but I want you to share more of that because you've studied it and you've asked the questions of people, not just us kind of looking at what are the leadership saying, because that's important, but you're also asking voters what they are perceiving and how they feel about these things and what's driving their politics.
Yeah, you know, I'm quite worried. All right, so I'll just say, like, I was born in 1968, so I'm 55, and I have been, you know, I've got more than 25 years of my adult life of, you know, really observing American politics and this intersection of religion and politics. I've never been more concerned than I am today about what I'm seeing, you know, and I think it's because we have had, you know, particularly over the last 5 to 7 years. And I think with the advent of kind of Trumpism and the Make America Great Again takeover of the Republican Party, what's essentially happened is a number of guardrails have been breached, right? Things that it used to not be okay to say now are okay to say out loud, and there's not political repercussions for it. And I think that, you know, those things matter, right? The leadership level, right? What I remember George W. Bush, just to kind of make sure I'm not, you know, just picking on Republicans here, but like one of the most important things that George W. Bush ever did was after 9/11, he stood up at a mosque and made sure, one, he did an appearance at a mosque, and he made a point of saying, we are in a battle against terrorists. We are not in a battle against Muslims. Like, and he made that distinction, and he made it over and over. He was the first president to use the word mosque in a speech in describing the American religious landscape. Like, you know, we usually say churches and synagogues, and he added mosques to that list, churches, synagogues, and mosques. And so he played a really important role in kind of tamping down. Now we still had outbreaks of violence, but I have to think he actually saved lives by doing that. Right. And then we've had, on the other hand, you know, these awful white supremacist events in Charlottesville, Virginia, marching around a statue of Robert E. Lee and literally chanting, "Jews will not replace us," you know, while they're marching around the statue of Robert E. Lee, and a president who was saying there's fine people on both sides, right, at an event like that. And so I think there's been this unleashing and permission given, you know, that we're still reaping today. I mean, and even the, you know, the stuff with Israel and Palestine is spilling over into U.S. politics. And we had a 6-year-old boy stabbed to death outside of Chicago by a person shouting by their landlord, stabbed his mother, killed the son, shouting Muslims shouldn't be here. Right. And that's spilling into our politics. So I don't know. I'm really worried about, you know, where we are. And the other piece that I highlight in the book is that, you know, among people who believe that America is a divinely ordained promised land for European Christians, they're far more likely to support political violence than other Americans are, right? So, and which makes sense, right? If you think you've got a divine mandate to hold on to this no matter what and by any means necessary, it would stand to reason that you'd be willing to support political violence. This is exactly what we see. You know, it's a third of Republicans today who say that true American patriots may have to resort to violence. Those who believe the election was stolen, it's nearly half who say we might have to support political violence. But it's rooted in these claims. You know, if we think back of other expressions, the last thing I'll say on this is about, you mentioned the Jewish community. But, you know, one of the early letters that George Washington had to answered was actually from a synagogue, from the leaders of a synagogue, who said, "Hey, in this newly formed nation where we are an extreme religious minority, do we have, you know, are we going to be second class citizens because we're not Christian?" And he answered them very straightforwardly and said, "Absolutely not. Right. The only thing required is to affirm the laws of the Republic. Like, that's what it's required to be an American." You know, and so from the very beginning, we've had forces, you know, saying that, and we've also had the other forces with us laying claim to this kind of European chosenness as well. And I think that's one of the challenges, is that we have just been wrestling with these two ideas for our entire history. They predate the Republic. They came into being with the Republic, and they've just been with us, you know, and so part of what's going on, I think, is that the country has changed demographically enough that we're at a kind of moment of reckoning. You know, that forever, you know, white Christian people could sort of pay lip service to democracy, knowing that they had enough a lock on power, right? But we're now, the country is only 42% white and Christian today, right? Even as recently as 2008, it was 54%. White and Christian. So just in the last 20 years, we have crossed this threshold. And I think it's that has brought out, you know, this reckoning quite frankly, the panic among many, particularly conservative white Christians, who see this as their country and kind of feel like it's, you know, their ownership of the country is slipping away.
Yes. I can't remember the context, but I was having a conversation not too long ago with a friend, talking about power. And even as you said those statistics, I thought, yes, but I don't know the statistics, but this isn't what is represented in power holding political positions.
Right.
It's not 42% white and Christian. It's way more than that. That's my technical statistic there is it's way more than that. Right. And men, I will add, you know, that as well. And even looking that we haven't ever had, we've had one president who wasn't white, no presidents who have been female. And I don't think we've had any who haven't confessed to be a Christian in all of our nation's history. And so there, you do see the panic because the public is changing. And yet at the same time, I think that's part of the fear is that the public is changing. Right now, the power still exists in those places with those people. But what if, right? What if people who are representative of the public vote in people who look like them?
Yeah. Well, I'll give you one for you're in Texas, right? Texas is only 1/3 white and Christian, right? 1/3. But if you go down to the Austin,
thank you,
kind of look at the legislature, that's not what it looks like.
That's right? Exactly right.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, you know, in Texas, for example, there are more religiously unaffiliated people than there are white evangelical Protestants in the state of Texas. But you would not know that from looking at the power structures.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. You wouldn't know that from looking at the power structures, and you wouldn't know that by how the lines are drawn for districts. And frankly, this is one of the things this is a different subject for a different day, probably. But one of the things I said to Andrew Whitehead, we were talking about white Christian nationalism. And you know, I asked him one of these very complicated questions, right? But my response was, yes, but people who hold the ideals of white Christian nationalism are just so loud. So you may not know that in Texas, just walking down the street with the signs for the politicians that you see or the petitions that people are asking you to sign or the t-shirts that people wear or, you know, whatever, it feels very loud.
I think one of the reasons why it's loud is because it's taken over one of our two political parties.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you don't get much of a bigger megaphone than, you know, especially again, in a country that only has two, that's a big pulpit and a big megaphone. Right. So, you know, this other thing that's kind of alarming to me just in terms of democracy is the parties are sorting themselves, I think, because of these concerns we've been talking about along lines of race and religion. Right. So the Republican Party today is 70% white and Christian in a country that is 42%. White and Christian. The Democratic Party is about 1/4 white and Christian, right? So, I mean, just in that kind of racial, ethnic, religious identity, you've got like the divides writ large, like before you know anything about their platforms, right? Like that's going to tell you, and those divides have gotten bigger over the last few decades in terms of race and ethnicity. So, and because of that, you know, like 1/3 of the Republicans are just white evangelicals because they all load into that one side of the party platform. So their voices get amplified because they are such a big part of one party, right? They just kind of have this partisan megaphone. And then you mentioned the other, you know, the problems with gerrymandering are serious because they not only ensure that a Republican or a Democrat is always elected in a particular district because of the way it's drawn, like no, the other party and many of them don't even have a fighting chance. So if you win the primary, you win the election, right? On so many of our districts today. But that also means that it incentivizes people to go to the extremes in those districts, right? If you're a Republican running in an all Republican district, you're not looking over your left shoulder. You're always just looking over your right shoulder. Who's going to be more conservative than you and really more extreme than you? But that means they're more and more out of step with the whole state. Right. So we've got a real challenge, I think, structural challenge that means these voices do get to be louder than they in fact are, but it also means they've got more power than they should in fact have.
Yeah. I want to bring us around to one of the other things that you mentioned in the closing of the book, because the second half of this title is The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. And the last couple of chapters, we've hit on a few things in this part of the conversation that you mentioned in your concluding chapters. But one of the things I'd like for you to talk about as we kind of start to wrap up is this, the way that it's kind of, I don't remember the way you phrase it, it's much better than this, but it kind of ebbs and flows, or it's kind of like, you know, two steps forward, three steps back sometimes in the movement forward. So again, to go back to the way we're saying, kind of three chapters on each region in the book. One is on the indigenous history, and then a kind of case study there is the language I'm using, and then one on the African-American case study, and then one on how has that region moved forward since those events, and what does that look like? And one of the things that struck me, I think I'm remembering this correctly, from the Oklahoma chapter, that third Oklahoma chapter, there was a centennial, there was a committee formed for the centennial of the Tulsa race massacre that happened in the Greenwood district. And you used Governor Stitt as an example of kind of what you're talking about with this progress. So he's on the committee and yet what?
Yeah. So he's on the committee. He, while he's on the committee, sponsors one of these so-called critical race theory bills, right? That's going to prevent the very teaching of the things that the committee is trying to unearth. And the committee ultimately kicks him off. The committee,
I'm so like he gets kicked off his own committee. I'm laughing over here because of how inconsistent this is.
It's really troubling and inconsistent. And a similar thing happens in Mississippi, right? Where Governor Tate, so Mississippi, I am proud to say, is my home state and has the only civil rights museum that has been funded by an official state that exists. Now I went there fairly skeptical because of that the first time I visited, because I was like, okay, what kind of, civil rights story is Mississippi going to tell about itself? But it turns out that it's actually quite honest, and frank and good. I would say I true confession, I really came armed to write a hit piece about how terrible it was. And I walked away really moved by the story that they had told there. But some very similar thing happened, right? So the state of Mississippi is standing up this laudable, tell no holds bar, tell the truth story about its very troubling history. And at the same time, Governor Reeves is sponsoring a bill to suppress the teaching of African-American history in the state of Mississippi. So I think, but here, I think these things are actually, not unrelated. I think that part of what we're seeing, when I last looked, there's only 12 states in the country that have not had legislation introduced to suppress the teaching of our history. Some variety of critical race theory bills, many of them name the 1619 Project as something explicitly that cannot be taught. They're all cut and paste bills, right, from the same source. But it's a national movement. But I think, if you ask yourself, well, why in the world in 2022, 2023 is this happening? Like, why do people feel like it's worth spending their capital on? I think it's a question worth asking. And I think it's because there is a reckoning happening. And I think that wind is actually quite powerful and blowing, and is changing things. And I think these are responses to change. So yes, in some cases they're successful. Some cases, they just make a mess of things. But it's important if we step back from the kind of day-to-day stuff that we see that, oh, actually the country's changing. The story it's telling about itself is actually changing. It's becoming more honest. Trying to wrestle with these difficult truths, trying to honor histories we've tried to suppress, and that's really important. And so I actually take some, even though I get really frustrated sometimes, but I take some, solace in the fact that those are reactions, to progress and change.
So last question. Someone picks up your book and they are in a similar place that maybe you've seen friends be in, or maybe you were in 5 years or 7 years ago or 10 years ago. And meaning they're not required to go to a high school history class anymore. And they've done their college studies and they're just curious. But the things in this book may come as a surprise to them. What words of encouragement do you have to them? What do you say that you say, please just keep reading? Don't put it down.
That's a great question. And I assume the person I have in mind as you ask that question is someone who looks like me, right? Probably from a weight, some kind of Christian background. I do end the book, although I wrote the book for a general audience, I just felt like I did need at the end of the book to kind of turn to that audience, to kind of people who look like me, share my background, I call it a benediction and call at the end of the book, right? To kind of bring us along, but that comes at the end. So it kind of at the beginning, I would say this, like, use the word curious. To wish for more curiosity, more humility, more curiosity. I think that is what we need more than anything else, right? I'm thinking of James Baldwin, who's really shaped my thought a lot, African-American writer, from kind of middle of the 20th century. He was so, insightful and eloquent. And kind of unflinching with his addressing kind of white people, in one interview he gave, I cite this in the book, but in one interview, it stays with me. He was asked about white people and kind of what African-American people thought about white people, and particularly their approach to history. And he said, we certainly know white people well. We know them, one might say, in the way that a mother knows her children. And then he said this. He said, we have come to see them, as the slightly mad victims of their own brainwashing. So, if we take that seriously, and I think it's fairly accurate, the history we have gotten is so impossibly naive and so impossibly innocent. Like, that in itself ought to give us pause, right? We know enough about ourselves and our immediate ancestors to know, or just about ourselves to know that that kind of history is likely to be a fairy tale. And yet it's what we so desperately want to believe. But I think it's time for us to kind of grow up, really. And for me, like, it's motivated by, I don't like to be lied to, and I've been like really angry, frankly, like when I think back at teachers I love, pastors I loved, who just wouldn't tell me the truth. And in many cases, maybe they didn't know it either, right? I'm kind of willing to kind of go there, but I think many of them knew more than they were willing to tell. I think they're not all off the hook. What I'm hoping is that, people who look like me and my background will just come to a more mature, place, I always veer into Christian terms when I get in this space, but, a more mature walk, right? Discipleship, like those kinds of things we talk about. And by the way, like, none of that stuff ever promised to be comfortable. Right. I mean, I think all the stuff about making white people uncomfortable, I just, when I hear Christian people saying that, I just kind of throw up my hands. Like, what are you talking about? Like, where did you possibly get the idea that discipleship was supposed to be comfortable? Right. It's not. It's about facing difficult things, but not just for the sake of that. And this is the thing, I think I'll end on this, but I think the thing that white Christian people have missed, right, is that, like, we have something at stake in getting this right, right? We have something at stake in telling the truth about ourselves and about how we got here and our truth about our relationships with African-Americans, indigenous people, Latino people, immigrants, Muslims, like Jews. Like, we have a responsibility to understand, like, if we look around and we think, well, how can this be? I think the one thing that all this history has helped me do is to kind of have more empathy about, like, oh, well, I, okay, I understand why things are such a mess. I've got a responsibility to try to do my part and kind of repairing that damage. And, there's a line that I think many white people too is like, oh, it's too complicated. And, you know, we wouldn't know who to compensate. And like anytime any kind of repair conversation gets off the ground. But, I wrote this line in the book. It's something like this, that the evidence is that greed spawned a million schemes. We were infinitely creative, right? When it came to defrauding people of what was theirs. But when it comes to repentance, like we just throw up our hands, right? And say it's too complicated. But if we applied, I don't know, half of the effort that we applied and the creativity that we applied to defrauding people, we come up with some real solutions that would make a real difference. And we'd find that, it not only heals other kind of our relationship with other people, but I think this is the thing that I heard from the activists on the ground in all three of those states, particularly the white activists in those states, but it was healing for them, right, at the end of the day.
That creativity line about the greed and versus the repair was one of the many places that I underlined and starred and dog-eared in the book. It was incredible. Yeah. So thank you so much for that word, Robbie. Thank you for this conversation. It's been, it's been really, it's hard, but it also feels hopeful. And I think that that's part of what it, at least it seems like you wanted to bring in this book and of course in your work. And so I'm really grateful. The book again is The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future by Robert P. Jones. And I will put the link to where people can grab this in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you. It was a great conversation. Thank you.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.